The following Real Assets Advisor podcast is a production of its parent company, IREI, Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For your most curated, intelligent news, data, and insights, visit realassetsadvisor.com and sign up today for our complimentary newsline and magazine using our new chat feature.
This podcast has been sponsored by Juniper Square. Juniper Square is transforming the private capital markets industry with solutions and services that streamline fundraising, investment operations, and investor reporting. Designed for commercial real estate, Juniper Square is trusted by hundreds of investment sponsors to manage more than $1 trillion in real estate investments. Reach Juniper Square at junipersquare.com.
Where did you grow up?
So I spent the formative years outside of New York, in Harrison. My dad worked in Manhattan. That was till I was about 8 years old. And then he made the trek west. We did a pit stop in Dallas for 6 months. Job didn't go quite the way my dad expected it, so he came all the way to San Francisco. And I now view myself as a Bay Area native.
Tell me about, is there anything about your youth that stood out in terms of just if you were to describe your childhood in a word or a sentence, what would you say?
Yeah, I would say I was pretty driven from a pretty young age. My family loves to tell the story of when I was in kindergarten. I came home with back then we had math workbooks, like workbooks that you would work on for the full year. This thing was 300 pages long. I took it home one early weekend in the year and I finished it. I was just kind of driven to, I can do this myself. I'll just get it done. I don't know really what drove that. I think there was an element of, wanting to create a sense of, I don't know if it's just financial security or just overall security, job security, family security. Not that my upbringing was incredibly rocky or anything like that. But I think I took on at an early age, I'm going to need to take care of myself.
Good instinct.
In the world's competitive, and you got to find a way to distinguish yourself one way or another. Driven, from an early age.
Talk about your college years. Talk about being driven. You went to Stanford, and I believe you got your undergraduate and graduate degrees both at Stanford. Okay. Talk about being a Cardinal. What was that like?
Yeah, the reason I was attracted to Stanford is when I was in the eighth grade, my father went through the Sloan program at Stanford. He was going through a career transition, and the Sloan program is basically a one-year MBA, executive MBA. They actually don't give them an MBA, it's an MS, but he was at the Stanford GSB, and I was 13 years old. We moved down to Menlo Park for the year. I did my eighth grade down there, and spent a lot of time on campus and, seeing what life was like at Stanford. And I think that was the point at which I realized, well, if I could, I'd like to come back to Stanford for college. And I can remember my mother saying to me, well, that's a good ambition to have, but, we'll see how that all works out. And so I feel very fortunate, that it did work out. Stanford was a great place for me. It was a great, socializing opportunity. I was not formally in the Greek system, but back then at Stanford, we all participated in the Greek culture. I was active in sports. I grew up doing a lot of sailing ever since, with my dad. I started 3 years old on the boat, but I sailed all 4 years at Stanford, pretty much 4 days a week. The best part of sailing at Stanford was the practices, because it was just a great break from schoolwork. We would go out on the water at 3:30 and get off the water at 5:30, and we'd have 10 to 15 boats racing or more. It was just great experience. I also skied on the team for a year, snow skied. I grew up doing a lot of skiing. I thought that would be fun. Did that for one season. It's a club sport activity at Stanford, so it's not as serious as other sports. And clearly the academics, I thought Stanford was a great, experience in that respect. That's why I decided to come back for business school.
So you studied industrial engineering. as an undergrad degree. So what did you have in mind when you were studying that? Did you have something specific that you wanted to do with your life?
Yeah, industrial engineering really is the business major at Stanford. I mean, you can do econ, but econ's viewed as kind of a lightweight major. Industrial engineering is more the path to business school. I will say I was heavily influenced by my freshman RA, resident assistant. He was another industrial engineering major. At that time, he was a senior. He was going off to Morgan Stanley for a two-year program, had done a deferred admit to the Stanford Business School. And I, in some ways, I followed his path. I mean, doing industrial engineering, I applied to Stanford Business School as a senior coming out and was planning to defer for 2 years. That was part of my application. I was going to go to McKinsey for the analyst program and then come back to school. I knew that was what Stanford was looking for. They really don't like people coming straight out of undergrad. They want some element of business experience, and 2 years is kind of the minimum. So I took advantage of that, that RA that gave me good advice. I will say my father was also an industrial engineering major from MIT. I think that had some influence that, I could see that path leading into business. But I think when I told my father I was going to do industrial engineering, I think he was a little surprised, wondering if that, why, and, really time in motion and, what does that really mean? And had to explain a little bit what the curriculum means at Stanford, where it's a lot of finance, it's a lot of accounting, it's a lot of strategy, organizational behavior, those types of topics. It's almost a mini MBA.
Tell me about the single characteristic. Obviously, everybody has multiple characteristics that lead to success. But if you were to identify your most pronounced characteristic that you think blazed the path for you, led to your success in business, in education for that matter, what would you identify?
Yeah, I mean, it sort of ties back to the prior comment I made, my kindergarten years driven. I'd say disciplined. I mean, I am a highly disciplined, probably, my family would say probably to excess. I look back, I was a chubby little kid for 5 years, and it set up over 40 years of daily workouts. I worked out this morning. I can't remember the day I haven't worked out. I'm disciplined about work. One of the things I try to focus on is I never end the day without cleaning out my inbox. That gets harder and harder with multiple inboxes between Teams and Outlook and LinkedIn and everything else that we've got going on. But, I try to not leave people waiting for me. I want to be highly responsive and available. It's disciplined. It can be an asset or a liability. Anything good taken to extreme can be, bad. And so I try to make sure I'm still being flexible. I'm still trying to be creative and thoughtful and not doing everything the same way each time. That's the danger with being disciplined is you can be a turn the crank. To think about that, both positive and negative.
Yeah, that's a good point. Tell me about your workout, your core daily workout. Is it weights? Is it aerobic? Are you on some kind of, is it stretching? Are you on some kind of rotational sort of workout, muscle confusion and all?
Yeah, all that type of stuff. Mike, you must work out pretty regularly too. I do a largely weights workout every day, but I rotate through different weights. So I have a good home gym setup. But before I had a home gym set up, I did things at home still. And then for aerobics, I do more swimming. I swim, particularly with COVID, I've been able to be more regular with swimming. I was swimming last night. My pool, fortunately, was able to stay largely open through COVID. They just went to a reservation system, and you had your own lane, and it was limited time. Mm-hmm. You made the best of it. Now they're back relatively reopened, but I used to be a runner. I view myself as I was like the worst person to be a runner. I could count on my hands, on one hand, the number of great runs I probably had in my lifetime. I'm just not designed for running. And, unfortunately I was in a car accident in my early 20s, got 5 screws in my ankle and decided no, running's no longer really a good idea. So, swimming, weight training. I think what I've taken from running to swimming is, you know, it is this monotonous, somewhat boring activity, and so it lets your mind wander. I mean, your mind has, either you can think about the pain of I'm only halfway through, or why am I hurting so much and I'm so early in the swim. You know, you got to let your mind go to other things. And so it just does. It wanders. And I find myself thinking about, you know, this discussion, you know, an issue I've got with a team member, an objective I've got that's not met. I mean, it just, you wander through these topics, and it does bring in new information.
Interesting.
So I got to say, for aerobics too, during COVID, in my home office here, I also have my rower. So a big thing I've become a fan of is the Concept 2 rower that, you know, was the best buy during COVID. It took me 3 months to get it. Everyone figured out they needed a rower at the same time. But that's another good workout.
Yeah, do you get enough, I don't want to get off track here, but just quickly, does it give you enough muscle resistance? My big thing about rowing is I love the motion, but it feels like it's never really creates enough muscle resistance to feel like you're developing your back or keeping it really toned up.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a compliment to weight. It's a killer workout, though. It depends on how long you go. I mean, I as you age, your endurance gets better, and you slow down, and your strength, you know, maybe isn't quite what it was, but your endurance gets better. So I gotta say, I have my rowing workouts tonight, and you know, I go 90 minutes on it nonstop, and by the time I get off that thing, I can hardly walk. Your
minutes.
Butt hurts so much. And,
oh yeah, 90
and you
minutes.
You can set the resistance. you know, there's certain people that say it's better to do intervals and, you know, go hard at it. You know, take a break, go hard. You know, I watch TV as I'm doing it, and it's a substitute for swimming or running. It's sort of a consistent, long aerobic, elevated heart rate activity. And,
yeah. So, Andrew, tell me about a time that you failed at something and you learned a lesson.
I'll tell the story of one that might seem a little bit surprising. I'll tell that, you know, early on in my Schwab career, I got the responsibility to lead branch merchandising. And I was doing a variety of marketing activities. And so I had responsibility for branch merchandising across the country. And, you know, and part of my objective was to get the posters down. I mean, I felt like we looked like a donut shop in some cases with, you know, posters taped up to windows and not professionally, you know, displayed. But, you know, the failure I had is, you know, my co-leader, you know, at the time said, you know, we got to redo, you know, our artwork, you know, in our branches. And, you know, Schwab was going through a transition from service provider to advice provider, folks in the branches being less transaction focused to being really financial consultants and, you know, helping clients, not just being order takers. And so, yeah, we got down this path of, well, we're going to create new artwork, and we convinced ourselves that we need customized artwork. And so we set up photography shoots and, you know, had all this strategy around our custom artwork, and we ended up spending $1 million on stuff, and it did not stand the test of time. And it truly, there's plenty of artwork out there, and I think we overviewed what was the purpose of artwork in our branches and felt we had to create something on our own. So, you know, I look back on that and said, yeah, I spent $1 million of the firm's, you know, assets in a pretty poor way, and it could have been solved if I just asked a few people, you know, for guidance and advice. You know, I kind of went with the gut call. I trusted the one person that was leading the area. You know, we just decided to wing it and do it. And, you know, a little bit of bringing in some others with, you know, a little bit more experience and asking for their help and opinion, and really wouldn't have slowed us down at all. And I think they would have said, hey, there's a lot of stock photography. Everything you're going to shoot, there's stock photography of. And there's other artwork you can use if you decide, you know, to not use photography. And so I look back on that and think, you know, yeah, it reminds me that my gut is not always right. And it, you know, taking the time to ask others for their point of view, you don't always have to go with what others, you know, the guidance they give you, but, you know, Schwab's a large organization, has a wealth of perspectives, take advantage.
Right. Yeah.
And not just the internal Schwabies, but clients, third parties, you know, depending on the issue, there's a lot of resources to draw from. You're not alone.
I'm curious about your own financial situation. Are you a saver or a spender?
I am a big saver. I've been a saver since the very early years. Back when I was living in New York, you know, relatives would give me checks, you know, for a birthday or something, and in the early years, I would just hold the check. You know, I get called from the relative, "Why isn't Andrew cashed my check?" It wasn't that I was spending it. That's just how I saved it. I'll just save that check. I opened my first bank account before I could sign for it. My oldest brother went in and co-signed with me, so I could open a bank account. I think I was 5 years old, and you had to sign in script. I didn't write script yet. So I've been a saver since the earliest years. I can remember when I crested my first $100. I can remember the first thing I spent $100 on. It makes me well suited for Schwab. I do have this passion, belief in financial security. I think we have individual responsibility to define that. For me, it started at a very early age.
So when you do spend money, what's your priorities? What do you spend money on? I mean, other than your basics, you probably, obviously you spend it on exercise equipment. What are some of your other priorities?
I clearly spend on my family. I've been married for, 30 years now. I have two kids. My daughter's in med school here at UCSF. My son is home for the summer. He's a computer science major at Northeastern, going into a sophomore year.
So I would imagine if I looked at your portfolio, I see a guy who's pretty risk averse. You're a saver, and it sounds like you probably like to conserve what you've saved, and your portfolio is probably pretty risk averse. Is that accurate or not?
Yeah, probably risk averse a little bit to an extreme. I mean, I almost feel like I have a barbell portfolio of a fairly, risk averse investments. And then I'm heavily concentrated in Schwab. As anyone who's been at Schwab, I've been in Schwab now over 25 years. And even though I've diversified over time, it's still a good concentration. Schwab's been a great place to invest. So in some ways, I feel good with that barbell. A good chunk that's safe and secure. And then still betting on Schwab and, some in the middle.
So what's the most exotic or riskiest thing in your portfolio, if you don't mind my asking? And it might be something on the side. I mean, not necessarily in your IRA or 401k or whatever.
Not anything particularly risky. I mean, I got to say, when the financial crisis was coming, or we were going through it, and the Fed, the government stepped in with, the relief package they put in place. I can remember the day that happened. I went in and invested heavily in some of the ETF, the financial services ETF. And usually I'm not a reactionary investor like that. I'm more of a dollar cost averaging, just regular monthly and a set of investments, and don't pull the trigger just because of today's news. But that's a case where I went in because of the news, and the learning for me there is it was not an investment that looked good for about 3 years. It now looks very good, just given how things had rebounded, particularly in financial services lately. But it was a little bit of a learning lesson. So I try not to be hot news, jump in. I'm more the person, I got to say, when the market goes down heavily on a day, I think I smile a little bit. I mean, I'm probably more satisfied with avoiding a $100 loss than a $100 gain, or call that $100,000 loss, $100,000 gain. It pains me more to lose than to get some unexpected upside. That's classic risk aversion.
Tell me what attracted you to financial services.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, to me, it's inherently an analytic, exercise. It's a very tangible activity. it's very much, you know, on people's minds. I mean, I'm not excited about areas that, you know, I look around and, you know, if I worked for Yeti and I was making coolers, would I really be that excited? I mean, is that really important to the quality of my life? I say I use it every day, but I you know, different consumer products, I probably not that exciting. I mean, I did interview with places like Clorox and Frito-Lay early on, and I can tell stories about that, but, you know, financial services, it's meaningful to everyone. And it's constantly changing. I think it's the, you know, that it offers constant problem solving, you know, given that the dynamics are always changing. It's somewhat interesting in that the objective really doesn't change. The objective is financial security, but how you get there is constantly changing from a product perspective, from a, you know, market discipline perspective, you know, personalized investing, ETFs versus mutual funds, zero commissions, alternative investments. I mean, the opportunity just proliferate, and helping our clients navigate through that, figure out what really makes sense, is a good ongoing intellectual challenge.
What do you consider the turning point in your career? And I'm asking this knowing that you also spent time at McKinsey & Company, and I want to get to that in a little bit. But if you were to identify, and what I mean by turning point, sometimes people, they realize that they're in the right field because something happened, or their career, something happened that accelerated their advancement or what have you. So you can interpret it a lot of different ways, but if there was a turning point in your career, what would that have been?
Yeah, I mean, I think when I started my career coming out of Stanford, you know, and this sort of goes back to what we discussed prior, you know, I almost felt like I would do anything to drive financial wealth. I mean, not anything from an ethical standpoint. I mean, I wasn't looking to do something corrupt, but you know, from a professional standpoint, I was like, I was looking to maximize income and wealth, and you know, McKinsey was a good path for that. McKinsey, you know, likes to sell. You know, your annual compensation is going to compound at 10 to 15%. Every year, and that just adds up, you know, if you're pursuing being a partner or a director, and there was a very clear path to making that at a firm like McKinsey, or, you know, really any professional services firm, but McKinsey, Bain, BCG, Booz Allen, you know, at that time period, I went to McKinsey saying, you know, this is my path to financial security, and interesting work. I mean, I could talk more about that. But I think there was a time at McKinsey, I mean, I went there 2 years as a business analyst, went back to business school, and then came back 5 years, you know, before coming to Schwab. And I think over time, I was starting to see the impact on quality of life. I can remember sitting in meetings and looking over at a partner that would be sitting next to me who had his calendar out, and then looking at it and just going, oh my God, you know, the amount of travel. I mean, I was traveling a lot, but, you know, as a young associate, you generally travel to one site per week, and you're there 3 to 4 nights a week. And, you know, I look at a partner, and, you know, he's traveling to 3 sites a week, and it's no longer just domestic, it's international. And the idea that you would fly to, you know, to Paris for a one-hour meeting sounds really exciting. Wow, I'm going to Paris. But then you realize you're really not enjoying Paris. You're going from an airport to airport, and then to a conference room, and back to the airport. It's not a lot of fun going on. It's a lot of seat time in an airline and a lot of time away from home. And I think there was a point at which I realized the balance of life is more important. Yes, financial security is important, but you know, how much is enough? You know, what do you really need? What are your personal objectives? And that's why, you know, I try to balance now, you know, family, fitness, and career. And it's not career beyond, you know, and money above everything else. And I think for me, that was just an awakening of what's important to me. I mean, it's, you come out of college, particularly a place like Stanford or any, I think any organization, but, you know, there can be a herd effect. You see what other top performers are doing and you're feeling like, well, that's what I've got to do. It took me a little bit of maturity to realize, no, you know, there's a path to personal satisfaction, which is probably different from the herd. You've got to chart your own course, and that's really what led me to Schwab. Much more of a balanced lifestyle while doing very meaningful, interesting work.
Now, did that, was Schwab a client? Was Schwab a client when, is that how that happened?
No. I mean, that's normally the path for folks, you know, out of consulting as they go work for a client. It's funny, in some ways I did a lot of financial services work at McKinsey. There really wasn't a financial services firm that I served that I wanted to work for. I mean, maybe I saw all the warts, but there was really no place that I wanted to go to. What was interesting about Schwab is there were a number of ex-McKinsey people at Schwab, you know, when I was looking to make the jump. And I was able to go and talk to them. And, you know, what struck me is, you know, they were all in very different roles. Despite having a fairly homogenous consulting background, you know, one person was leading up new electronic brokerage products, you know, pre-internet. You know, another guy was leading the strategy team. That's kind of what you would have expected. And another woman was on the call center side. It really felt to me that Schwab was willing to bet on capability and potential, not necessarily just experience. And I just saw that in the other ex-McKinsey people, and that's partly what attracted me.
Interesting. So, but how did the position, did you get called by a recruiter? Did you see a position come open? How did it actually, where was the interface?
Yeah, actually, it was through, you know, one of the ex-McKinsey people, actually someone who was in my class at McKinsey, had been at Stanford Business School with me. We were close. He made the jump to Schwab. I stayed in touch with him. He was part of the strategy group. He was going to be moving into a fixed income role. And he was somewhat hiring me as his backfill, but also positioning me with Schwab was maturing at that point, and they were growing the strategy function. So they brought in a senior leader from BCG, who was the West Coast financial services lead, so a fairly senior guy, and I was basically his first hire. So my McKinsey person got me started, but I got to give the BCG guy who came in really gave me the role.
So your current role at Schwab, you're managing a suite of technology platforms that are used by more than 7,500 investment advisors, according to my notes here, and the custody assets with Schwab. Can you talk about what kind of tech platforms are you managing? What do they do functionally?
Yeah. I mean, first thing I would say, Mike, is I'll update the 7,500 number, because with TDA integration, we now serve over 13,000 independent RIAs. Schwab is now over $7.5 trillion in assets, and the advisor services business is roughly half of that. So it is a significant part of Schwab, a significant part of the advisor industry, which is just growing, continues to grow. Probably one of the fastest growing segments of financial services is fee-based independent advisors. So my team has responsibility for all the digital platforms that an advisor would use to interact with Schwab. So that starts with what we would call our custodial platform, what we call Schwab Advisor Center. That's probably the mothership. That's where an advisor would go to open a new account, to move money, to do account maintenance activities. So a lot of the basic custodial functions, are supported by Schwab Advisor Center. But we have a number of customized platforms to help them with specific needs. So, advisors need to do portfolio management, meaning they need to do performance reporting and billing and other forms of reporting. So we have a portfolio management system we call Portfolio Connect. What makes us unique is, most advisors have to go out and buy that platform from a third-party provider. We provide it for free, and it has a number of other advantages for advisors that use it. So portfolio management, we do trading platforms, sophisticated trading platforms for an advisor. So we have a product we call Street Smart Edge, which is the legacy Schwab platform. With TDA coming over, we've got a platform called ThinkPipes, which is really an industry-leading, very robust trading platform. It enables an advisor to do bulk transactions, block trades, sophisticated options trading. It provides real-time streaming data. They see level two quotes. I mean, all the different things like a very sophisticated retail client would be interested in, but taken to a further degree for an advisor. And we also offer rebalancing platforms. Advisors need to rebalance all the portfolios of their individual clients. And so we have a platform we call iReval. Again, another platform that came from the TDA side that we're integrating in. And then we also have product platforms. So digital advice. We have a platform we call Institutional Intelligent Portfolios that enables an advisor to set up a digital advice platform for their end client. What that means is basically set up an asset allocation and we rebalance it. We give reporting. It becomes a one-stop shop. In terms of supporting that end client. And so advisors find that very useful for certain clients. So it's a broad range of platforms, and I also say we also support the third-party community because there is a wide range of vendors that support the tech stack of a particular advisor. And they'll do trading platforms, they'll do portfolio management platforms, they'll do client relationship management CRM like Salesforce, type platforms. We integrate with all of those types of providers. So we have over 180 product integrations that we support. And really that's part of our philosophy of we want to enable advisor choice. As an advisor, these are business owners, they have their own point of view of how they want their technology to work, and we want to enable choice. So if they want to use Schwab platforms or they want to use third-party platforms, we just want them to use Schwab. So we want Schwab data and capabilities to be where they want to go, and that's what we support.
Now, you also established the firm's Global Data Solutions Unit. What is that? What kind of data are you generating or curating or what have you?
Yeah, I mean, maybe just a little background to that is, as part of my, my path at Schwab is I generally say I've had big jobs and small jobs. Big jobs, I ran the branch network for a period of time after a number of sales leadership roles. I ran Schwab.com for 6 years back in the days when, apps were just coming out and we had to figure out, do we need an app? What's going to happen with apps? And I've had smaller jobs that were kind of startup situations. I helped create what we call Schwab Private Client, which was the first time Schwab charged clients for a Schwab point of view, where we charge for advice. And we have over $160 billion now in Schwab Private Client. It's been incredibly successful. And I also had an opportunity our CEO, Walt Benger, pulled me in and said, hey, Chuck and I have an idea. We've been doing retail branches for 40 years. We've been doing the advisor services business for 25. We want to do something in between. We want to franchise retail branches. And so I helped create what we call independent branch services, where we now have 80 locations across the country, which are run by franchisees. You wouldn't know it because they look like standard retail branches, but it's an independent owner who has equity, kind of like an independent advisor. But they're hanging the Schwab shingle. They're selling Schwab products at Schwab pricing. So it's just another way, for us to bring talent to the firm and to expand our reach. So Global Data was another one of those startup opportunities. I was approached actually when I was leading the branch network. I'm in San Francisco, as you know, and a key leader came to me and said, we're surrounded by digital natives here. I mean, we got LinkedIn, we got, Uber, we got Airbnb. I mean, we got all these firms that, basically exist on their data, to the degree some assets, but, have really managed their data. And the question was, what should we be doing with our data? Are we optimizing our data? Are we organizing our data in the right way? What should we be doing? And it started as really a business-focused effort. What was interesting is the regulators back then were not really focused on data, how we were governing our data at all, but they've woken up to that, and now they are extremely focused on that, and not just from a privacy perspective, but just if you're reporting this number in your financial reports, how do you know it's accurate? What's the source data? What's the lineage from source to production? Can you show how that's documented? What quality checks do you put in place? All those types of questions have happened at Schwab really over the past 5 years. So Global Data is really a group that is very focused on how are we governing our data at Schwab, and how do we optimize it? And it's for analytic use cases, it's for reporting use cases, a variety. But, you know, we sit on this wealth of first-party data. I mean, when I first started in the role, we looked at a lot of third-party data. How do we bring in social data? How do we aggregate outside sources? The real opportunity is more just getting your arms around the first-party data and making good use out of it, because we generate a lot. Whether it's web analytics and what's happening on the web today and what people are looking at, traffic into our branches, transactions that are happening, there's just a ton of data. It helps us better serve clients when we harness that power.
So I want to talk about McKinsey & Company just a little bit. You made clear, it turned out not to be your cup of mocha, but it led to good things for you. How many years were you there, first of all? And can you talk a little bit about...
7 years in total. And I'd say, you know, that the thing the insiders say at McKinsey, it's not, are you going to stay at McKinsey forever? It's how many years are you going to stay? It's very much a pyramid structure. It's an up or out, structure, and many opt out for a variety of reasons. And so it's always a question of how long you're going to stay. I mean, my plan was, I did the 2-year business analyst. I knew I was going back to business school. McKinsey runs a program where if you're performing well as you're going back to business school, they offer to pay your business school. It's kind of McKinsey ROTC. They basically take out a loan in your name, and if you come back, they pay it off over 2 years. If you don't, you get stuck with a Citibank loan. So I knew I was pretty much coming back for 2 years. My plan was pretty much to make manager and then figure out what I really want to do. That would have been a 2-3 year. Once you're in 2-3 years, it's a little like, a lot of roles that are well structured. You can see the next opportunity just a year or two away, and they kind of keep you in. So I stuck it out for 5 years. But, the point at which I left, I was a senior engagement manager. The next step would have been partner in the old partner structure. I just realized it was going to be another year or two to make partner, and then no one leaves after making partner. I mean, they stay in the halo of that for at least a year or two. So I was like, do I really want to stay 4 more years, or is it time to move on? And for me, that was the right time.
When are you most productive, Andrew?
I am most productive when I can focus. We talked about this. It could be when I'm swimming and my mind can wander. It can be when I'm sitting outside doing emails on a weekend and I don't have meetings to run to, and I can be focused in thought. Often it's, in the morning, before I get pulled into emails and issues of the day. And, like a lot of people, you're in your morning shower and your best thoughts come. Like, wow, that's a good idea. So it's whenever I can find focused time where I'm not distracted, and you got to find those opportunities.
I'm curious, every once in a while I meet people who they've got something about their work style that's different. It's somehow idiosyncratic or even ritualistic. Is there anything about your work style that's notable that you would point to?
It's sort of what I mentioned before of, I don't like people to be waiting on me. I mean, I think there's an element of respect. If someone is asking me something or needs something from me, then I'm highly responsive. So I do feel I'm a little bit of a slave to email and inboxes and whatnot. It's just the way Schwab communicates. I can't remember the last time someone tried to call me. There are a few people at Schwab who try to call me occasionally, and then they get my voicemail and I have to get them back. Because it's just the way we work. So I think that, that desire to not leave people hanging, that's part of just being, we're very a team-oriented culture, and want to make sure I'm not the one slowing down progress.
So when you're recruiting people to join the team, what characteristics are you looking for? What would be some of the just characteristics that you seek to identify, because that's what you either feel like works for chemistry or helps a person succeed in a variety of ways?
Yeah, I mean, I'll point to some things that I think are important at Schwab. You know, we have what we call our leadership brand and have four characteristics of the leadership brand, so I definitely look for that. And then I'll throw in two more that I think are critically important too. But, we're very focused on our leadership brand that, that focus on people, purpose, collaboration, and courage. Being very people-oriented, being able to work in teams, not being an island, that's very important at Schwab. We're a purpose-led organization. People that, buy into that objective through clients' eyes, to and through a successful retirement, doing well by doing good. We want people that, find that motivating. Collaboration doesn't mean groupthink. It doesn't mean everyone needs to agree, but, we like to be able to get ideas from a broad cross-section and a diverse perspective, and so that's important. And then courage. Courage to bring up things that maybe the group doesn't agree on or might be difficult for the group. And, we are a challenger brand. We want to be challenging the industry with new ideas and thought. And so we need people that have courage to bring those things up and not get sucked into groupthink. So those are sort of the four, part of our, I'd say our leadership brand. But I also think it's critical. I look for curiosity. Is someone inherently curious? Do they ask a lot of questions? Are they trying to figure things out? Are they the type of person like to pick things apart? Are they trying to figure out a better approach? Maybe that's the engineer in me. I definitely like, curiosity. I also think that drives engagement. I look for humility. I think that's a very much a feature of leadership at Schwab. That I don't necessarily have the best ideas. That branch merchandising story, tap the power of the team. Just being humble and everything. So looking for that characteristic too.
What's the first thing you do? Let's go to normal day, normal times when you go to the office, and you might be going to the office some days of the week. What's the first thing you do when you arrive at the office?
I'm a slave to email, so I dive into email. I would say first though, if I was going into the office again because it's been so long, we're all at this work from home. Generally the first thing I do is I went to the Schwab Cafe and I get an iced tea and I'm a cereal person, so some dry granola, and I might socialize a little bit there at the cafe with folks. I mean, that's more my normal routine. I'm a ferry commuter, being in the North Bay, so I get off the ferry, I come into the office, I'd go straight to the cafe. A little bit of refuel and a little bit of socializing, and then I hit my office, and if I don't have a meeting immediately or something I need to do, email tends to be the magnet that sucks me in.
What's the last thing you do before leaving? Back on the email?
I usually am, closing out things, responding. I will say, since I'm a ferry commuter, the email doesn't stop when I leave the office. I'm an iPad person from the ferry. My commute is, I say it's an hour door-to-door, but it's 45 minutes of productive time because I'm sitting on the boat. Usually, like most people on the ferry, we're all down in our laptops, whatever, our tablets. So usually the last thing I'm doing is, I like to say if I was in the office, the last thing I would be doing is I'd be saying goodbye to folks, around me. I miss doing that, I'm not necessarily the last person to leave the office. I'm probably not the first person to leave the office, but there's usually some folks that I'm seeing as I'm walking out, and I like to thank people. I'm a big believer in showing gratitude, and I might see a person that led a meeting that day and being able to say great job, you really turned the group around on that issue, and so I if I was back in the office, you know, having that beginning of the day where I could do a little bit of socializing, you know, those collision meetings that you just don't have in a remote work style, and then being able to, you know, show some appreciation at the end of the day, you know, as I'm walking out the door, miss that too.
You know, you sound like an extrovert, but that can be deceptive sometimes. Do you consider yourself an extrovert or an introvert?
Oh, I am an introvert. If you ask my family, they would say, well, Dad, he's an introvert. I mean, I recognize, at work, that's part of the role. I'm a people leader. You know, I got to let people know what I'm thinking and give guidance and be the coach and, be participative. And you can't be too introverted. And, it's part of the, I don't want to downplay the benefits of McKinsey. When I was there, it was a great early experience. I learned a lot about data gathering, about communications, written, verbal, how to influence leaders, how to build peer-to-peer relationships with senior individuals that, I early on thought I was 20 years younger than that would be a burden. I mean, there's a lot that McKinsey taught me around foundational skills, and also taught me the importance of some of the attributes that Schwab really excels in: leadership, brand management. Those were practice areas at McKinsey, and I wasn't quite sure why they were so important. But when I got to Schwab, I realized, wow, this is really where Schwab is exceptional. And there was a point in my Schwab career where I was going from an analyst. When you're an analyst, undergrad, pre-business school, you speak when spoken to. I mean, that's kind of your role in a senior client team meeting. And then there's a point at which you become an associate and a team manager. And I can remember, a partner saying to me once, it's no longer speak when spoken to. You got to be out front. Be vocal. And it kind of woke me up in some ways. Like, yeah, now I need to mature to a different role, and I got to be more extroverted. And so it doesn't come natural. I think I'm clearly more comfortable with it, over the years. But it was an evolution. Early on, I was, it was more of a struggle.
Interesting, yeah. Because I would have guessed you're an extrovert, but then you do a lot of activities that sound like they're kind of meditative. I mean, being on a rowing machine now you may be listening to an audiobook, you might be watching some television or whatever, but or for that matter, swimming, it sounds like there's time that you have a lot of activities where you're inside your own head.
Yeah, my family would say that, probably too much so. But I do think that is, it's restorative in some ways. I mean, having that time to reflect and think and prioritize and to sort things out. I mean, if you're in meetings and listening to others, and I mean, particularly in this remote world, the challenge of this remote world is everything needs to be scheduled. I mean, there are no collisions. It's just you're not going to bump into someone in the hallway. I'll bump into my son, but I'm not going to bump into a work colleague. And everything's planned, and it fills up as a result. I mean, my days are back-to-back meetings. And so you need to find the time to just sort of pull back and, are we going in the right direction? Are we working on the right things? Do I have the right people working on the right things? Do I have a nutrition risk I need to address that I need to have more front and center? I mean, those things take some thought to prioritize, and I need some separate time. And so for me, it is that swimming, rowing, working out in the morning a little bit type activities. It helps me. I think I'm better at work when I've got that time outside of these work activities. Because for me, I never fully unplug from work. Even when I'm on vacation, occasionally I try to stay off email and do all those types of things, and I do a good job at that. But still, the things are blown, they're still filtering through your head, and new ideas come along and you take advantage.
Describe your leadership style.
So I like to give my folks a lot of responsibility and empowerment. I think of myself as a collaborative leader. I like to joint problem solve with folks, but I like to give them the autonomy to make the decisions and the discretion to make the decisions, to come to me when I can help. You know, I view my role as in some ways being grease for the gears, you know, finding out where things are stuck and getting them unstuck, you know, either because, you know, a team member mentions it or, you know, I just see it. So a very collaborative style. You know, at the same time, I think it's important to have a plan and to know what the priorities are. So, working through with the team to figure out what that is, ensuring that we've got broad-based support, just given the nature of Schwab. An empowering, supportive, collaborative, you know, approach is, you know, what I use with my team.
Mm-hmm. What is the most exciting thing happening in your world these days?
Yeah, I mean, it's the majority of what we're working on. You know, is TDA integration. So, you know, we are integrating, I think, as you know, with TD Ameritrade. You know, we announced the deal, or the deal went final tail end of last year. We've been very clear it's 30 to 36 months to consolidate our broker-dealers. You know, that requires a lot of platform consolidation. You know, TDA had separate platforms that they're using to support advisors. Some of those were keeping, others were integrating into our platforms, and so there's just a ton of work. And you know, what's great about the work is integration is not a distraction; it's an acceleration, because what we're enabled to do is, you know, integration is providing resources to do things that we've had on our roadmaps for years. We just didn't have the resources or commitment. And so this need to get to a single broker dealer, you know, is giving us funding three times the level of funding that we've had in recent years. And so it's exciting because we're able to accelerate a lot of things we've been talking and wanting to do, whether that's onboarding solutions, you know, streamlining move money, you know, eliminating paper and digitizing everything that someone might need a paper form for, straight through processing so people don't need status on things. You know, we're just accelerating a lot of efficiency drivers. And technology is so critical for fee-based advisors because, again, they're small business owners, and if they want to grow, either they're driving efficiencies or they're inflating their cost base. And most advisors would say, I want to find a way to double, but I clearly don't want to double my staff. And so technology is the enabler of efficiency. And so it's great when we're able to roll out new capabilities that they're seeing, you know, drive efficiencies. And I'll give you one simple example. We rolled out earlier this week, you know, a new digital onboarding solution. It's, you know, how an advisor would open an account and fund an account, fully digital. What makes it complicated for advisors is they want to complete all the paperwork, then their end client needs to authorize it. So it's more complicated than a retail relationship. And we're just hearing incredible feedback from advisors. I mean, we've had a version of this, but it didn't have integrated funding. So we're doing more. Advisors need to include documents. There's a whole suite of features that make it more onboarding focused. And, you know, to hear comments from advisors, God, you're saving me, you know, 30 minutes for every client I would have had to onboard by virtue of this. That's what we're here for.
In what ways do you expect your industry to change in the next 5 to 10 years?
So, I mean, there's a question of, you know, advisors, how much that's going to change, or financial services. I'll start with financial services. I mean, I just think, you know, this ongoing recognition that people are going to self-determine their financial future and they need to take responsibility for it, and there is no financial safety net, is just going to be more and more of a factor. You know, millennial generation, newer generations coming on, I think there's just a recognition of, maybe it's something I recognized when I was 5 years old saving pennies, is I've got to chart my financial future. And I just think there's a broader appreciation of that. And so how do I get engaged early? How do I make sure I'm making the right decisions? What are the right decisions for me, not the right decisions for someone else? Just this level of engagement that we've seen in financial markets, you know, definitely spurned by, or motivated by zero commissions. I think we're just going to see more of that, and more, less of the play money focus, and more of the, know, am I set up for my future? Just partially because I just think there's a view of probably the most precious asset we all have is time. And, you know, how do I set myself up to enjoy the time I'm going to have here on Earth, whether I'm working or retired or for my family? And, you know, managing finances, you know, plays a critical part in that. And I just think that's only going to grow, the awareness of that. And as a result, I think fee-based advisors that play a fiduciary role, you know, go beyond best interest standard, completely on the side of their clients, with that entrepreneurial mindset, driven to really provide exceptional value because it's their business, is going to continue to grow. I mean, it's just a winning model for financial services. And, you know, and it's great to see the variety of financial advisors that are out there, you know, customizing by different areas, whether it's industry focuses or money managers, planners, life planners, tax preparers, you know, they play the gamut. And I just think, you know, given the desire of investors to control their financial future and the unique value proposition that advisors play, both are going to grow.
This podcast has been sponsored by Juniper Square. Juniper Square is transforming the private capital markets industry with solutions and services that streamline fundraising, investment operations, and investor reporting. Designed for commercial real estate, Juniper Square is trusted by hundreds of investment sponsors to manage more than $1 trillion in real estate investments. Reach Juniper Square at junipersquare.com.